Hello and welcome to TJ's Garden 2.0. I'm calling it 2.0 because I'm doing a soft reboot. The first year I did some great interviews, I did some great episodes I liked, but it was a mess, and I'm going to try to be slightly less messy. So this year I'm focusing on humanity, community, and gardening, because I feel like those are things we all need in our lives. So I'm going to try and gear interviews and my discussions towards that. But I wanted to follow up on the seed starting special I did and talk about one of the main nutrients you need for plants and maybe a little bit about why you don't actually need that for seed starting. We're going to be talking about nitrogen today. Nitrogen has an atomic weight of 7. It is a other non-metal on the periodic table. It is an atom, but we usually deal with it as molecular nitrogen, specifically N2 or dinitrogen, which is the atmospheric form nitrogen takes. You're breathing it in right now, as am I. What I am talking to you now is mostly modulated nitrogen. It's like, I want to say 70% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. And it is the hardest thing to get into your plant's roots because its natural form is very, very, very stable and very, very, very strong. One way nitrogen gets broken down and actually can get into the soil is lightning strikes. A lightning strike is strong enough to break up the bonds between nitrogen as well as breaking up the atmospheric oxygen, or O2, which has a similar two-atom bond. It can break both of them up and recombine some of it into NO3, which is nitrates, which is what plants can take up. So every time a lightning strike hits the ground, it is, to a degree, fertilizing the soil. Obviously, that's not sufficient to cover most plants' needs, so there are other paths for this to take. One way that it helps to break it down is that it can be broken down by nitrogen-fixing bacteria. When we talk about cultivated plants, we're talking about two main types of nitrogen-fixing bacteria. There is the soil-borne bacteria, which many plants will actually cultivate to a degree. They will produce exudates in their roots, chemicals that their roots release into the soil in the area called the rhizosphere, which is the area right around the roots. And those nitrogen-fixing bacteria kind of work for all plants. And they're basically, they're not fixing nitrogen to help the plants. They're fixing it as a byproduct of their own biological processes. They're breaking that complex bond to get access to certain things, and then they just happen to release nitrogen in the form of ammonium, or NH4, into the soil. And then from there, another group of bacteria, who again are doing this to further their own life cycle, break that down further into nitrites, which is NO2, and then nitrates, which are NO3, if I'm remembering all those right. And so it goes through that whole cycle to go into your plants. Now, if you've heard the words ammonium, nitrates, nitrites a lot, you might be an aquarist, because that's how I learned about them in the first place. A big part of learning how to get the balance of, you know, bacteria and everything right in your aquarium is that you're talking about that nitrogen cycle, right? Fish and other living things, we do it too, release quite a lot of nitrogen in our waste. And that nitrogen has to cycle through this whole process so it doesn't build up and provide a toxic environment. And yes, nitrogen is primarily found in waste. So the other path is in the roots of some legumes. And most recently in the roots of corn. If you go back to my corn episode, I talk about this a little bit. There's also a bit of a ethical issue with how we're trying to get those into other varieties. It's complicated, and I don't know if I'll ever deal with it in full. I dealt with it a little then. Definitely go back to that episode if you kind of want to know what I'm talking about. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can hunt it down if you want to. But it's primarily in the roots of legumes, agriculturally, that we're interested in it. And when they actually found out about nitrogen fixation legumes, what we found were these little nodules that would become infested with nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And if you hear noises in the background, I'm at home recording with my daughters, and they're a little noisy. But I'm hoping I've set things so they don't get picked up. Anyway, the nodules in the roots of legumes are basically a haven for nitrogen-fixing bacteria. They take up residence in those nodules that the legume is providing them. And in return, they provide nitrogen to the legume. Now, it was thought when this was first discovered that this was a way it got into the soil as well, that it would produce excess or abundant nitrogen, and that nitrogen would be released and help fertilize other plants. And that's where you get a lot of companion planting ideas from, where they say, you know, grow this with beans or peas or whatever, or grow peas before you grow another crop to put nitrogen in the soil. What we found out subsequent to that is, while it may slightly increase the nitrogen living in the rhizosphere, the nitrogen living in the actual legume are providing nitrogen for that legume. They've done studies and they found that the soil nitrogen doesn't dramatically increase when you plant beans or peas or whatever. What does happen is they're producing their own nitrogen, or rather the bacteria is, and as such, they aren't taking nitrogen out of the soil. So when you grow beans with corn or any other crop, and the beans have formed this relationship, because they won't form it if there is abundant nitrogen. If there is abundant nitrogen, the bean will kind of cut its losses and just draw from the soil. It won't bother forming the relationship, which is incidentally why if you're growing a ton of legumes and you want to see if you have the right bacteria in your soil and the relationship's functioning healthy, pulling one up and checking its roots for the nodules is not a bad idea. But basically, the bean gets the nitrogen going in the nodules, grows healthy. If there's not enough nitrogen in the soil, it'll grow healthy from those nodules. The nitrogen ends up in the bean plant, and then a good chunk of that ends up in the final beans, flowers, etc., which we then harvest. So you're actually pulling that nitrogen out. So the best time, if you're trying to grow legumes for nitrogen, and the reason why we do what's called green manure crops or cover crops this way, is you let them grow until just before they flower, just as you start to see the flowers form. And then you cut it low and you allow that all to rot. You can turn it into the soil if you want, but even in a no-dig situation, you're basically just allowing it to sort of be mulch. And then that nitrogen will be returned to the soil. Some of it will be lost atmospheric nitrogen, just as in the nitrogen cycle at different stages. Some of it is always lost because nitrogen really wants to be N2. It doesn't, and I say once, it's obviously not, that's me anthropomorphizing. It doesn't want to be N2. It's just the most stable natural state it can enter is N2. And so it will always go back to that if it can, functionally. But yeah, so you'll lose some, but a lot of it ends up in the soil. So growing beans and legumes as a companion plant with, say, corn or any other crop, it's not that it's going to provide nitrogen for your other plants. It's that it's not taking nitrogen from the other plants. So you can grow it alongside these plants that are heavy nitrogen feeders. And provided the other ones aren't heavy phosphorus or anything else feeders, things the legume actually does need to take up from the soil, there won't be a ton of competition. Corn has always worked pretty well because corn primarily feeds nitrogen and is a bit lighter on the other nutrients. So the bean, which more heavily feeds on the other nutrients, doesn't compete as heavily with it. There's still probably some competition going on in that soil, but usually there's enough to go around in that situation. So generally speaking, while it isn't technically a great companion plant for the purpose of fertilizing your other plants, it's a good cover crop, it's a good green manure, and it is a good neighbor. It's just not helping, it's just avoiding hindering, which means it can work, but it's not going to help anything else, at least as near as we can tell when they study the soil around them. But yeah, that's how nitrogen gets taken up. Now, the reason why nitrogen is so vitally important to plants, it's that first, when you look at the profile on a fertilizer, it's NPK. Nitrogen is the first of the macronutrients, the big nutrients, the nutrients plants need a lot of. And it's put there for a good reason, because plants cannot photosynthesize without nitrogen. And the reason being is the chlorophyll, the little green pigment molecules that actually do the photosynthesizing, or the majority of it, they're what harvests the energy from sunlight. They get agitated by the sunlight, and that energy provides the energy for turning the carbon dioxide and everything else into long sugar chains, which become the carbohydrates in plants, which are the energy for all life as we know it. So let's kind of break down photosynthesis a little, and then this will make some more sense. So what happens is a plant takes in carbon dioxide, water, sunlight, and it produces oxygen and sugar molecules. Now, the steps it does this, it's actually kind of weird because we often think of plants as breathing in carbon dioxide and breathing out oxygen. But plants don't do that. Plants break down water and release the oxygen molecules from the H2O. Then it uses the hydrogen, sunlight, and CO2 to make sugar molecules. And it does these in two steps. And all this happens because of the chlorophyll, which are rings of nitrogen molecules. It's a molecule that has a ring of nitrogen atoms and then one magnesium atom in the middle. That gets agitated by sunlight and provides the energy to do the chemical work that is photosynthesis. So the plant takes up the water, breaks up the water, releases the oxygen, keeps the hydrogen, takes in the carbon dioxide, uses that to build up the sugar molecules. The sugar molecules are basically a stored energy source. Then, just like you or me, the plant breathes in oxygen, and in its mitochondria, those little things, we all heard this in school, it's the powerhouse of the cell. The mitochondria uses oxygen to break down sugar molecules into ATP and other transport molecules that then later get broken down again to use that energy to do work in the cell. So sugar can kind of be thought of as the batteries or gasoline or whatever you want to consider a fuel source. They're the fuel that makes life work. And plants have to breathe oxygen just like us to break that fuel down and do anything with it. So carbon dioxide is not breathed in. It's taken in to make sugar molecules. Which means that, yeah, there are actually two cycles going on here. Water becomes air. Air becomes water again later as it bonds with other hydrogen atoms and becomes water molecules again. And that cycles in one cycle. And then the other cycle is carbon dioxide gets turned into sugars. Then when you eat a plant, when you breathe in air, that air is used to break down the sugar. And then the carbon dioxide from the sugars is then released back into the air. So yeah, it's kind of fun, right? And that whole system is why your plant needs the nitrogen. Because if it can't make the chlorophyll, it can't take the sunlight, it can't make the sugar, it can't then break down the sugar and get the energy to do anything. So everything depends on those sugars, which depend on photosynthesis, which depends on nitrogen. Which means you got to get nitrogen in your soil. Now, for most of human history, we had a very simple way of doing this. We took animal manure or human manure, and we used that either straight on the ground or composted. Later on, we realized that a lot of our diseases were coming from using this stuff uncomposted, and so they started composting it. That's why there's a difference between so-called night soil, which is literally collected human waste thrown out on a field, called night soil because they would tend to pick that stuff up at night in the communities that traditionally did this. And actual composted manure, like humanure. And I'm not going to talk about humanure in this episode, although I may do an episode on it later. But I will link to the humanure handbook in the show notes so you can look it up. It's interesting. But anyway, we would compost those wastes, put them on the field. That provided the bulk of our nitrogen, as well as other things. Now, most manure sources aren't very high in nitrogen. Steer manure, for instance, is not especially high in nitrogen. Chicken manure is, actually. Human manure is also. Pig manure, I think, is kind of in the middle, as is sheep manure. But yeah, they're not ridiculously high, but they're good sources, and they tend to release over time. Fish, by the way, are also a great source of nitrogen, as is fish water and aquaponics, but that's also another episode. But yeah, so we get most of our nitrogen from animals. And then we discovered guano, which is petrified bird poop or bat poop. And suddenly there was a race to claim all these little rocks out in the middle of the ocean somewhere that had nobody living on them. They weren't habitable, but they had flocks of birds that would settle there seasonally to reproduce, and they would leave layer after layer of poop. And over years and years and years, this stuff built up in these big petrified mounds that we could then harvest as a nitrogen source. And so there was this huge rush at one point in early American history for these, and the laws are still on the books. If you manage to find one of these rocks, and you're not likely to, because almost every single one that you could imagine has already been claimed by somebody, but if you did find one of these rocks in international waters and you claimed it for the United States, there is a way to get money from the federal government for doing that. And it's still on the books. It is unactionable because all of the islands have been claimed. You're not likely to discover one. The only ones that aren't officially claimed are still within somebody else's waters. So there's no way to do this, but it is still on the books. So there's that. That's the legacy of the guano wars. Then you had guano. Then they came up with the Haber-Bosch process, and that's where our synthetic nitrogen comes in. So with Haber-Bosch, you use a bunch of chemicals. Some of them are petrochemicals, so there is an issue there with the oil industry. But you use some chemicals. It involves passing some as steam through others. And I am not an expert on this process, but the end result is you get essentially ammonium or synthetic urea, which is the base of a lot of synthetic urea-based fertilizers. And yes, urea is exactly what it sounds like. There is a factory. There are, in fact, multiple factories out there where all the people's day job is making fake pee. That is a thing that delights me to know. And so you have the fake pee factories, which incidentally, synthetic urea is also one of the components of synthetic caffeine, which is a whole other weird thing I learned one day that is not going to get its own episode because it's not directly related to what I do, but it's just interesting. Anyway, so that's synthetic fertilizer. Now, you'll hear people say synthetic nitrogen or synthetic nitrogen-based fertilizers a lot. And the important thing to remember is your plants don't care. They do not care. They are incapable of caring because molecularly, these compounds are exactly the same as their synthetic counterpart or as their organic counterparts. NH4 is NH4 is NH4 is NH4 is NH4. It doesn't matter to the plant where that NH4 came from, or where nitrates came from, or where nitrites came from. They are all chemically the same exact molecule. The reason why it's important to distinguish synthetic sources is that they tend to be more concentrated, and they also tend to be closer to just the elemental thing. And then we take that elemental thing and we use binding agents and stuff that are designed to be water soluble. So what happens is synthetic fertilizers are really good at getting straight to your plant roots and doing their job. They're already ready to go. They can get in the soil. They can do their thing and they're good. The downside is they're very concentrated. If you use too much or too much runs off or whatever, this can end up in your local river. It can end up in your waterways. That's where we get the environmental problem. Organic sources, and I'm putting organic in air quotes that you can't see, so I'm not sure why I'm doing the air quotes, but organic is defined by like USDA organic and that sort of thing. Not organic chemically, because anything that contains carbon is an organic chemical, but organic in the farming sense. Those sources tend to be more bound up. Like they tend to be contained in things that need to break down or part of other molecules that need to break down or they need to be processed. So they tend to be slow release. They tend not to be very concentrated. Scott's turf products tend to be like in the 30 to 40% nitrogen range, and organic sources tend to be 10 or below. So they're not anywhere near as concentrated and they're not anywhere near as direct. They take a while. So you're not going to correct a nutrient imbalance in your plants by applying an organic source of nitrogen. It's not going to act fast enough to do that. You can do that with synthetic nitrogen. But at the same time, if you overspread manure or some other source of organic nitrogen a little bit, it's not likely to end up in your local waterway. So there are different products for different uses. Broadly speaking, I tend to use organic fertilizers more because they break down slower. I can source them easily. And I'm used to working with them. And I don't have to worry about them doing anything I don't want them to do. But I have used synthetic in the past. And I don't have an inherent bias against using it in the future. Because sometimes you need an immediate direct dose of nitrogen. And that's the best way to get it there. It just is. The Haber-Bosch process is not perfect. It definitely has problems. And there are definitely issues we need to work out with it. But as a source of nitrogen in gardening, it can be a direct solution to a problem versus the kind of slow and steady of an organic one. That said, again, I mostly use chicken manure when I get a hold of it. So I'm not here to over push synthetic fertilizers. I don't use them that much myself. In fact, it's been a few years since I've used one now that I think about it. But anyway, those are the sources. Now, a lot of your modern organic sources are coming from byproducts. So a lot of different seed byproducts as they're, you know, removing all the material around seeds and stuff for different food products or oil products. A lot of the byproducts of that are going into fertilizers. The entire fishing industry and even the fish farming industries, a lot of their byproducts end up in nitrogen-based fertilizers. Fertilizers like Milorganite are basically a byproduct of processing biosolids. So they use a big pond, fill it with water from sewage, essentially, seed it with the right bacteria, create an environment where that bacteria can thrive. The bacteria eats up all the bad stuff, essentially, in the sewage, but takes in all that nitrogen and concentrates it. Then they dry the pond, harvest the bacteria as a powder, essentially, that becomes the Milorganite that they then sell. And so that's a good organic source as well, but it's a little bit of work, but it is a byproduct, so it's kind of a way to use that. One place you're not going to get a lot of nitrogen is in most forms of compost, because compost is, and I can't say this enough, compost is not fertilizer. It is a soil conditioner, and it is very good at that, and you should be using it. You should find good sources of compost and use them. And there are things in the compost that definitely feed the soil life, but there aren't as many concentrated things to feed your plants. So it isn't technically fertilizer. That said, municipal compost from suburban areas often has quite a bit of nitrogen because it's usually made up mostly of grass clippings and people over fertilize their lawns. So you're getting the benefit of their Scott's turf grow in your essentially organic compost. I know that our municipal one here in Bakersfield, their compost has been tested before, and there's something like the 8 or 9 range last time I heard. This was from a soil science teacher who I took classes from at local community college. He had actually had it tested at one point, and it was about 9 or 8 for nitrogen, which is decent for an organic source. And so I use that quite a bit as well. But to make it very clear, compost from non-animal sources, that is to say compost that isn't composted manure, that isn't worm compost, that isn't other sources of animal-based compost, essentially, they're not going to be very high in NPK, and they're not likely to directly feed your plants. They are going to create an environment that is better for your plants to grow in, but they aren't going to themselves directly feed your plants. What they're going to do is improve the soil quality, improve the soil life, and that soil life can unlock nutrients in the soil itself, which can then feed your plants. So it can help, but that's not its primary purpose. And that's not why we're putting it in our gardens. And that's not why I produce my own, because my own compost made from my own plant material in my garden is not going to be very high in nitrogen. It's just not. I'm going to use chicken manure with it to provide that nitrogen source as well as some other macronutrients, but some micronutrients and soil and anything brought up by soil bacteria, worms, etc., because of that compost is going to benefit my plants. So anyway, that is everything I know about nitrogen. I am not a chemist, so if I've gotten anything wrong, go to tjsgarden.com and shoot me an email, reach out to me on Mastodon or Twitter, and let me know if I did get something wrong. If you have any questions, reach out to me in those places as well. I'm always available for questions. I might not know your answer, but I'll do my best. Anyway, that pretty much wraps it up. That's about all I've got to say. You know, go out and enjoy your garden and reclaim the full value of your labor. Have a good one. This has been TJ's Garden, and I'm its creator, Troy Truchon. And as such, I'm releasing this under a Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International Creative Commons license, meaning that you can share this, alter it, do whatever you want with it, provided you give me credit and you don't deny anybody the right to do the same with any derivative works. You can find the information on that license at the Creative Commons website at creativecommons.org.